Matthias, let's just take a second to talk about our Patreon channel. Obviously, a lot of people love the show, and we get a lot of messages from people asking us how to support us and help us grow the podcast. Now, Patreon is obviously, without doubt, the best way to do it. It really helps us grow the show, helps us pay people who help us out, helps us, you know, keep shining the job, the editor behind the scenes. Why do you want to just let people know what they get, some of the perks?
Yeah, I mean, we offer so many interesting extra things for patrons. I mean, we have a bonus episode, we do Q&As, and we're also looking into other ways of like getting our Patreon supporters special access to some of my very deep, fantastic knowledge and such things.
Yeah, you're wanting to introduce some, not one-on-one, but small group lectures on specific subjects, which I think would be amazing. Patrons would absolutely love that. I would absolutely love that. You know, half an hour topic of you just ranting without me interrupting on a subject has to be perfect. You know, who's not going to love that?
Yeah, like things, you know, we talk about on the podcast, maybe like we mentioned something about Viking ships or something that has to do with the mythology, and people want to know more about that. And then we can like dig deep into that for like 30 minutes in a short lecture. I think a lot of people would find that very interesting.
Yep. And I mean, let's not forget, anybody who signs up to the Patreon at any level is going to get a bonus episode every week. It's either going to be the story time episode that we do with Jonas Lorentzen, which you have to agree with, Hayes, is one of the funniest times you must have all week. It is brilliant. He does
such amazing.
A good job.
I love it.
It is. And then the other episode, we're still undecided 100% on what it's going to be, but it looks like it's going to be a conversational type episode where me and Matthias just get a little bit more personal about ourselves, but also we're going to let people have the chance to ask questions, Q&A, whether it's about the podcast or about us. You're going to be able to put your question to us through Patreon. And then we're going to have a little bonus episode where we explore those and people get a little bit more interactive with those, which I think would be fun for the fans.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I feel like I'm seeing with our audience is that they really like to be interactive with us. So we're trying to offer as many opportunities on our platform to do that outside of social media. Otherwise, because that can get a little much sometimes.
Yeah, there we go. I mean, honestly, if you just jump over to Patreon.com/ Nordic Mythology Podcast, you can have a look at all the different tiers we've got there. They start from $5 up to $20, and you can cancel at any point. You can try it out for a month, listen to the old episodes, listen to the old storytime episodes, cancel it if you don't enjoy it, and there we go. But we're more than sure confident that you'll like what you hear. Welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farrand, co-owner of the company Arns of Odin. Oh, fuck. Fucked that up. Fucked it up. Fuck, 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 fuck. Fuckity fuck. All right. Welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farrand. I own a company called Arns of Odin. That's Matthias Nordvig. This is a fucking podcast. There we go.
Fuck yeah. Yes. Welcome, everybody. This time, we are not joined by any guests. Today, we are... it's the 4th of July, so happy 4th of July to all the Americans out there. And in honor of the 4th of July, we are talking about revolutions in the Viking Age and in Old Norse mythology, see what we can find and dig up, where, you know, situations where the people turn on the greedy rulers, as the Americans did back in the 1770s.
Treachery. So,
yes, but the good kind of treachery.
no respect for the British overlords.
Exactly. No respect for the British overlords.
So if anyone wondered why the intro was a little bit different, this is our third attempt at trying to record the podcast. The first time Zoom kicked me out halfway through, the second time Matthias's laptop died. So
it's all fun and games.
It is all fun and games. yeah, this is a fun topic. And I think it fits well with kind of, unfortunately, everything that seems to be happening in the United States at the minute. I have no idea what's going to happen across the pond from me. It seems like every week there is some new thing to completely divide the country. It's from an outside perspective, and I think from like a European perspective looking over, it seems like a bit of a fucking shitstorm.
Yeah. As a European who lives here, it seems like a bit of a fucking shitstorm. Mm-hmm. But you know, there are good things and bad things in these processes. And I'm going to have to quote the eminent, what do you call him, mythologist, anthropologist, storyteller, Michael Mead, and say, you know, in these dark times, I'm not going to quote him, I'm going to paraphrase him. In dark times like these, it might seem like the end of everything, but that's actually the beginning of something new. So, let that be sort of a couple words of comfort.
Well, hopefully, unless it's a new old way, because things seem to be regressing a little bit. And
well, yeah, in some ways, and in some ways not. So, first things first. Obviously, what I assume that you're referring to here are the decisions that the Supreme Court of the United States have made. Recently, mm-hmm. on several issues, and primarily the reversal of Roe versus Wade, which took away the union wide right to abortion for women. Now, there's a couple of things to say about this. First of all, I find it fascinating when Americans refer to this union as a country and as a nation, because it's not. It's a union of states. This is really important to actually keep in mind. This means that there are local laws in different states. And if you look at it in that perspective, then what it means is that there's a right that the that the Supreme Court had previously said that everybody in the American Union have essentially protected through the Constitution. Now, the problem with that argument that was made about Roe v. Wade is that it was based off of the right to privacy. I'm not a legal scholar, so I don't know exactly how good of an argument that was initially. But this is one of the things that had made it, I guess, easy for some scholars to shoot it down, including the those who are now on the Supreme Court. I mean, obviously, we also know that they're motivated by their own political and religious ideas.
Definitely not
problematic.
Definitely not religion. Religion, is it? Fucking hell. It's not like religion's ever got anything to do with anything.
But if we look at the overall decisions that have been made in the U.S. Supreme Court, not just Roe versus Wade, but also some of the other decisions, what is actually happening is that they are curbing federal oversight. Mm-hmm. Or what happens in the states on multiple issues. There was another one with about the EPA, where the Biden administration wanted the EPA to enforce certain oversights on power plants and emissions and so on. And the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. If you're going to do that, Congress will have to make a law, right? And so this is actually quite interesting and important to consider, because what they're then saying is that those elected officials that you send to Congress, they will have to sit down and make a law that says that the EPA will have to do this, and then it will be appropriate. But to have the president's administration just tell the EPA, now you have to do this, and then that will change with the next president and so on, that's not acceptable, according to the Supreme Court. And that is, despite the fact that I think there should be this oversight, it is actually a good thing, because it means that the president can't just make any old decision, and therefore, you know, it actually puts, you know, more power in the hands of the people, in that sense. And so this, you can see these decisions that are being made at the Supreme Court in many ways in that light. And then you'll see that there's about 26 states in the US who have now who either have trigger laws, have imposed laws, or are going to impose laws that in some way ban or severely restrict abortion. But what people need to keep in mind is that it's very varied out there. There are many different versions of those laws. Some mm-hmm. allow for something and some don't, and so on. And that's an entirely different situation. I think, you know, anybody who wants to restrict people's right to abortion is pretty fucking backwards. But that is something that people will need to vote about in places like Missouri and South Dakota and Florida and wherever else this is going on. So, you know, it's not a good thing that a fundamental right has been taken away on a federal level. But on the other hand, what we are seeing is some other positive things, if you ask me, which essentially mean that people who are voting in the states get to have more to say about issues that concern them. Mm-hmm. So it's a little give and take on all of that. Now, you know,
it's just
the question is, of course, if these powers that be are actually genuine about all of this and they do want, quote unquote, more states' rights, or if it's just, you know, a transitional period until they can, you know, load up Congress with a bunch of evangelical Christians who hate everybody else. Now, that's another situation. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, I'm out of here.
I've seen the Satanic Temple are doing a lot to try and, because I think they're one of the few, like, quote unquote, religions that can legally, like, oppose a lot of this and get exemptions based on, like, whatever they have in there. I don't know if you'd call it a doctrine or not. So I know that they're doing a lot, kind of in terms of like legal action against a lot of states to try and, if you become a member of the Satanic Temple, then you are then exempt from not being able to get an abortion.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things to take into consideration here, and that is what I mentioned, that it seemed a little odd to me that the decision on Roe v. Wade was made based off of the right to privacy. And not, you know, other amendments to the Constitution, because, I mean, what I've read on this subject is actually that there's legal scholars who have said that, you know, it would be more meaningful to base it on other amendments, such as the 13th Amendment. So I don't know. As I said, I'm not a legal scholar myself. I don't know what would be the most appropriate thing to do here, but I don't think that you can argue based on the total content of the Constitution and its amendments that women can't have that universal right in the American Union.
I think ultimately, for me, anyway, it just comes down to human, basic human rights. And I know this is it is ultimately a women's right issue, but I think it shouldn't just be looked at as like a women's right thing. I think everybody should get behind this, because it's not just a case of, you start there and these rights are taken, and then it's something else. And even if people don't have a strong opinion on this, it's people losing very, you know, very simple rights that they should have. And just because you don't care necessarily about this issue or don't have stronger ideas doesn't mean that the next one isn't going to affect you, mm-hmm. or the one after that isn't going to be something that you care about. So you have to stand up for what you believe is right in the end. And for me, I unequivocally will always defend anybody's right to do whatever the fuck they want with their own body. And I and that comes down to whether it's this or whether it came down to the COVID vaccine, or it comes down to people's own right to end their own life through euthanasia or whatever other means. Like, I will 100% vehemently defend anybody's right to do with their body what they choose fit. And mm-hmm. I don't think anybody should ever have the right to tell you in any way. So certainly with this issue, I just think it's beyond my understanding that this has even happened. Well, in fact, if you'd have told like 16-year-old me that I could have made the maths a little bit easier. If you told 16-year-old me in 17 years that the USA is going to overturn the federal right to abortion, I'd be like, you are fucking insane. What are you on about? That's never going to happen. Never.
Yeah. No. I mean, this is the thing. It's crazy.
Let's not be around the bush in the fact that if it was the other way around and it was men being pregnant, this would not fucking happen.
No.
This would, if it was the other way around and it was men who needed abortions, this would not be a fucking issue. It would not be it just wouldn't be a thing. This wouldn't happen. So there it is, very much an issue.
So there's a couple of things that I want to say. First of all, I liked that you pointed out that the Satanic Temple is working on this. There are multiple.
I do. I love what they do.
Yeah.
I have a lot of love. If anybody hasn't checked those guys out, just go and find them.
And please don't confuse them with those fucknuts in the Satanic Church. That's a different thing.
They're not technically a religion. They don't really have anything that they necessarily believe in. They don't believe in Satan, but they are very against state and religion being mixed, and so what
technically they are actually a religion, right?
Technically they are a religion, but they don't believe in Satan. It's not kind of devil worshipping. They want to try and use this religious status to try and separate. Basically, all they want to do is try and argue the separation of like Christianity and state in the USA. So if in a state the Christianity put up a monument in a state building or on state ground, they'll then come along and sue and say, we want to put up one of Baphomet or one of some satanic symbol, just because it's like, well, if you're going to put up a Christian one, then we have the exact same right to put up one of what we want. And I think it's so important to have people like that who are trying to separate state and religion, because in this day and age, they don't fucking belong together. They just shouldn't be together.
But see, this is also what we're seeing other religious groups doing the same thing. We're seeing Jewish groups and Muslim groups who have voiced their opinion on this. Under Sharia law, abortion is legal. Just keep that in mind, everybody. Want to shit on Muslims. They allow abortion under certain circumstances. It threatens the life of a woman. If the child is not viable and such things. So that's something to keep in mind. And these groups are saying, well, you're now violating our religious rights to have abortions too. So there's something there. And this is what I was saying before, is like, you know, with the current Supreme Court that privileges religion, and particularly their own, obviously,
when we say religion, let's be honest about it, it's Christianity. That's,
well, yeah,
heavily towards, like, it's,
but it's also certain kinds of Christianity. What we're dealing with here are American evangelical Christianity and American Catholicism, which, by the way, people out there, is different from how it works in the rest of the world. American Catholicism is not the same as European Catholicism or South American Catholicism. It's really interesting how religion works here. So that's something to keep in mind as well. Obviously, there's still an American Catholic Church that is attached to the Pope in Rome, but we also see American Catholic bishops, for instance, recently with the current Pope's a sort of more lenient approach to homosexuality. You've seen the American bishops being like, oh, no, fuck what the Pope says, which then means you're not Catholic. That's the whole point of being Catholic.
Well, they can't all fucking agree with each other.
And no, they do, but this, yeah, this
they all the just thing, do. Right? They do. They say whatever is best to keep the fucking numbers up within the church.
Yeah.
Like, if them, it, they're that fickle that if it meant that the membership to Catholicism went up by 100% if they accepted homosexuality, they'd all be fucking accepted in homosexuality. Because that's how fickle it is. It's all about how many people they can get to join, how many people they can get to donate money. And it just that's all it comes down to. So they will say whatever they need to say to keep things going. And it's just, it's so annoying. Just stop giving a fuck about what people do. Everybody, I think it's just a lesson for everybody in life. Not just, just across the board. If it's not your business, stop caring what people do. Let people do what they want to do, love who they want to love, see who they want to see, fucking just fuck off, just let people be. And it's so frustrating that everybody wants to stick their fucking noses in everybody else's business when it's just, it's not your business. So it doesn't matter. If unless it directly affects you, you have no right to comment on it. You have no right to say on it. It's just their business. And it just...
I'm pretty sure that if we were back in the 1770s, we would have seen Dan... over here in the colonies with a musket in his hand. Freedom!
I'd have been on your side. Well, not say your side.
Definitely my side. I would have been right there with you. By the way, there was actually a very high-ranking Danish officer who fought. I have to say this because I'm Danish myself, who fought in the American Revolutionary War. His name was Hans Fibiger, and he was known as, I think, Old Copenhagen or something like that.
Fabulous name.
Fabulous name.
If a man ever had one of those curly mustaches, it was him.
Yeah, absolutely.
He had a curly mustache.
He ended up becoming the high treasurer or whatever you call it of Pennsylvania, and I think you can find his grave in Philadelphia. So cheers to that. And speaking of cheers, we're both drinking whiskey, or Dan has already started. I haven't started yet because I wanted to just give a shout out. The bourbon that I have here, and bourbon is real whiskey. Just so you know, Europeans, yes. Stop snobbing around with all your Scottish stuff and Irish stuff. I have a nice little bourbon from 10th Mountain, which is a distillery in Vail in Colorado that is dedicated to, or has named itself after the 10th Mountain Division of the United States Armed Forces, which is originally from New York and was created back in the 1940s, and they held some pretty gnarly positions against Nazis and fascists in the Austrian and Italian Alps. And I have been gifted this little bourbon by Guy Anderson, who's the guy I also tattooed the other day.
Right, Sean, Guy hasn't sent me any of that whiskey, so you have to cut that whole section out. unless Guy sends me some whiskey this week, that is not advertising.
Oh, fuck
it.
Off.
Get it out of here. No, that's good. Obviously, I'd happily want to support. I do want to try it and support that. You did a tattoo on poor Guy.
It was his idea. It was his idea. He was like,
how was it?
It was fun. It was pretty straightforward, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, if you go on Instagram and you see my line work, you can see that this is my first tattoo. But I think it's not bad for a first tattoo. Mm-hmm. It could have been much worse.
When we meet, you can tattoo me.
Are you sure about that, man?
If I could tattoo you back, now that would be a commitment. Yours is going to look significantly worse than mine, though. Well, I feel like that would be fun.
Yeah. But I mean, if you want to see the final product, you can always find my my Instagram account, and there's a picture of it there.
You did a bind rune, right?
Yeah, I did a bind rune with like sketched lines, so that you know you wouldn't.
It's meant to look like that. It's not just Mateus's bad tattooing.
No, exactly. But it was also, we chose that style because, you know, if I did fuck up a line, then I would, you know, be able to
for sure,
you know, switch it up a little bit. And there's also red in it to make it look, you know, a little more like blood and gore.
I thought you just made him bleed.
No. I realized that afterwards, it's like, oh, people could just like see that as like I really fucked up, but no, there's red in it. Cool. And there's also like a little bit like extra line, red line that goes down below it. That's actually just me scratching. It's not actual ink. So I just wanted to make
it looks good. It looks good. It looks significantly better than I think I could do. For my first, how's the whiskey?
It's fucking great, man. This is appropriate bourbon for 4th of July, man.
For the 4th of July special. I mean, I don't know. I'm not celebrating 4th of July. Fuck that. Like, no, because
it would be kind of weird if you were sitting over there in the UK celebrating 4th of July.
It's all about independence and freedoms and. Let's be honest, there's a lot of freedoms that aren't fucking there right now. So bollocks to 4th of July. And I think a lot of people are in the same boat as me. So let's talk about revolutions in the Viking Age. We can cheers to that instead.
Cheers to revolutions in the Viking Age. Yeah.
Let's learn about that. So first of all, what classes a revolution for a little dumbass like me? What is a revolution?
Well, okay, so this is where we, you know, there's probably going to be some like scholars of political science or students of political science that are like, these dumbasses don't know what they're talking about, because we call this.
Revolutions. I mean, if you're coming to us to learn about what revolutions are, then you're fucking doing something wrong.
Yeah, I think you are.
Don't come to us for that. Like, maybe come to us about Viking shit. Maybe.
Yeah.
Like 50% of us kind of knows what they're talking about. But if you want anything outside that, then we are just fucking guessing.
So what classifies as a revolution is a conscious overthrowing of a existing government to supplant it with a new system, right? A new system of government. Now, this is where it gets a little tricky, because can we actually like apply that definition to the historical accounts that we have in, say, like the Norwegian King sagas or something like that? And it's like, maybe, maybe not. It really comes down to, you know, if you believe what the material is telling you, which you shouldn't, because it's like written by a bunch of Icelanders like way after it happened, and we know that they were prone to lying about a bunch of things, so there's still something we can take away from all of this. And then of course also we have some references in the mythology as well that to sort of like overthrowing governments and, you know, replacing them with a new system. There's a lot of things we can actually work with here. But let's just, like, before we go all the way back to the Viking Age, go back to the time period of revolutions in European history, because there's some important things to keep in mind here about what happened and why. I think we have all heard of the French Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Dan, have you heard about the English revolutions? Yeah, okay, so the 1600s, my friend, the people tried to establish a republic over and over in your country, but for some reason modern modern Brits haven't heard about it. Wonder why. So, I mean, again, this is what we were talking about before we started the podcast, right? So you can refer to revolutions as revolutions. You can refer to them as freedom wars, like Americans like to do.
Right? We did have a civil war one time. A
liberation war and that kind of stuff. Yeah, you did have a civil war. Yeah, call it that. Or you can also refer to them as peasant revolts and that kind of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Civil wars and so on. But
I mean, our civil war was very typical in a sense of separating church and state. Mm-hmm. That was the whole basis behind it.
Yeah, but there was also actually the desire to create, you know, a republic. So I mean, there's like a couple of things to say about that. First of all, the way that something is cast as like either a civil war or a peasant revolt, by posterity. Those who come after and then write history, usually because they won, is perhaps not actually the way that it played out and the you know, desires and interests of the people who were involved. Sometimes these peasant revolts are very clearly, you know, for instance, a revolution that just didn't really work out. So we have to take that into consideration especially when you get into the medieval period, because, you know, the medieval period and before the Viking Age and so on, the source material is so scarce. And we don't exactly know what were actually the motivations of these individuals. Okay, moving on from there, we should also take into consideration that the way that we think about revolutions today has been defined by the so-called Age of Enlightenment. And the Age of Enlightenment is a curious time period in European history. And I would recommend that anybody who wants to know what it actually was, that they read David Graeber's The Dawn of Everything, because it actually lays out some very important issues on the Enlightenment and what actually happened. And I can, you know, give you a little bit of a spoiler. What actually happened was that a bunch of Europeans went from Europe to the Americas, and then they started building little settlements in the colonies over there. And then they started interacting with the Native Americans, particularly in the Northwest, the American Northwest, in what was called Norumbega or New England, and also New France. And what these Europeans learned was that life sucked. And that's what these Native Americans were showing them. And they also taught them a couple of things, for instance, rational discourse and reasoning. Things that we today as Europeans like, oh no, that came from like the Romans and the Greeks and so on. It's like, yeah, no. We have some pretty solid Native American critiques of European systems of government and societies that really lay bare exactly just how pathetic it is to live in a monarchy. And that had a great influence on what Europeans started thinking about their monarchies and eventually also their attempts to overthrow them, which happened in France, which was attempted in England, and was attempted elsewhere, sometimes with a little bit of success.
Allegedly happened in England. Allegedly.
Okay, so this is really important, because what does this tell us? It tells us one thing, one important thing, that this book, The Dawn of Everything, also highlights.
Which you just spoiled for everyone.
Yeah, it's like chapter three, so like multiple chapters.
I mean, and it's 300-year-old history. It's not like people who've been spoiling Stranger Things for me on Facebook, you fucking wankers. I'm not so which I'm not bitter at, which I'm not bitter about at all.
So what we learn in this book, basically looking at what Native Americans were doing and what Europeans then adopt and then attach to an idea of like what happened in ancient Greece, in the Roman Republic and so on, is that they had these assemblies with where you would have to present a rational argument for why you would do a certain thing and not do another thing and so on. And that was their system of government. Does that sound like something we know? It very much sounds like modern parliamentarism. And that's because modern parliamentarism is built on that. Now, did Romans and Greeks and other Europeans have similar types of systems back in the day? Way back in the day? Yeah, they did. And so did the Scandinavians. This is what is known as the thing in Scandinavia, mm-hmm. General Assembly or the Assembly. And you can see around Scandinavia that there are multiple so-called thing sites. You also find them in the British Isles, in places where Scandinavians have come by. For instance, on the Isle of Man, where you can find Tingwall. Now, these assemblies, they were basically this, it was like a system of government where people of a certain status, presumably, would have something to say, but not everybody, at least not in the Viking Age, maybe earlier. It's possible that when we go back to what we could call some kind of like tribal days or whatever we want to call that in early Germanic Northern Europe, that it was the entire tribe that actually had something to say in these assemblies. But in the Viking Age, we have more and more influence from the steep hierarchies of imperialism and monarchy and so on that we see in farther south in Europe. So we get sort of like a class of aristocrats called hersir in old Norwegian, for instance, and they get to decide what happens at the General Assembly. Mm-hmm. And then it starts looking a little bit more like what you know from, you know, early modern England, where the aristocrats get their own little parliament, where they can then say boo and ba to the king, right? You guys still do that in your parliament, right?
Yeah.
This is what I know the English parliament for, is like a bunch of people sitting on chairs somewhere going, meh, boo, blah.
Oh, it's like
anything short of throwing a tomato at somebody.
It's, oh, our parliament is laughable. If you watch it as an outsider, it's embarrassing, it's
quite hilarious.
So embarrassing. It's just a bunch of middle-aged white men just shouting at each other like fucking children. It's just unreal. And then we have a bunch of steps that are just not needed. So you have the House of Commons, which is the elected,
the stuff you vote for.
Yeah, the elected representatives. But then any bill there then has to go to the House of Lords, which is just a house of more middle-aged white men. But these ones you didn't vote for. These ones just inherited their position.
Are they middle-aged? I would say that they're kind of geriatric, right?
They're geriatric, but yeah, unless that one's died and then a son has taken the place.
Yeah, yeah,
right. So this is a bunch of people who you didn't vote for, who go, you know, then it has to go to them and then they vote and say whether they, but they can't really say no because they weren't elected. So they can kind of say no, but they can't say no. So how it works is they can say no, and then it goes back to the House of Commons, and then they say, okay, you need to look at this again. And then he goes back to them, and then this time they're not allowed to say no. So really, they have no fucking power. There's no point of them. It's just a time-wasting exercise. Doesn't need to be there. And then it then has to go to the Queen, who has to sign off to make it into a new, you know, into a new bill, make it to law. But she's not allowed to say no either.
No,
so
exactly.
So really, you've got these two fucking steps of people who you're paying a shitload of money for. They can't actually say no, can't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good in a sense that it's only the people you vote for who you can, but there's just all this formality that you have to go through that just holds up.
Like, and see, that's the result, right, of the 1600s, where the royal house was like, okay, if you guys stop like throwing stones at us and axes and whatever else, shooting guns at us, then you can have a House of Lords, right? And then at some point we also add a House of Commons, and that's for the rebel, the peasantry, the servants and the maids and all that stuff. That comes pretty late in current European history. And this is the same in my dear home country. We used to have a two-chamber system. Now we just have a single-chamber system, where we have what corresponds to the House of Commons in the UK. And then they vote for laws, and then they ratify a law, and then they send it off to the Queen. And then the Queen is like, okay, you can do that. Now, technically, I guess she could say no. I think last time that happened was back in like the 1920s, and it almost led to the king staging a coup and all that stuff. This was, you know, part of a whole situation of losing Flensburg to Germany and I don't know what. But so these institutions exist because there's like a history of development here, where people have essentially been allowed certain influence on government over time, because they were in the process of going full on guillotine and revolutionizing their system, right? And then the powers that be were like, hold on, what if I let you have cake over here for a little bit? Okay. Go have cake. So now I can stay king over here, right? Cool, great, awesome. In the meantime, I can be king as long as you want.
All right, you be king. I'm gonna go and eat my cake.
Yes, exactly. That's how
it would get me.
You're right.
I'd be hooked by the sink, and I'd be like, okay, hey, I don't care what you're doing. Give me that cake.
That's a power balance that has then been struck in a lot of European monarchies. There's also, of course, those European republics that have then been created, you know, by chopping off the heads of a lot of people. Like, for instance, the French Republic. Or the German Republic, that was like, you know, essentially Americans that showed up and said, no, you can't do that anymore. Now you will have to do this instead. And that made them relatively docile, thankfully. Okay. So what do we see in the Viking Age? Well, we see this like frail power balance between a conglomerate of primarily oligarchs who, you know, would essentially be the same as like the modern UK House of Lords. And then the king, who comes from these oligarchs and may or may not be an elective king, could also be a hereditary king. That really depends on when we are in time and where we are in time, space, not time. So, you know, it's very likely that, you know, in the early 900s in Denmark, it would be a hereditary king, and those like general assemblies, their power would be very curbed and sort of like not really functional. Whereas in Norway, the king might, you know, be some kind of hereditary king, but he definitely has a bunch of pesky oligarchs around in the country, especially in Merida, that he has to deal with, right? So this is like the power balance that they're working with. Okay, and then what about the rest? And we have all of these peasants, tenant peasants, landholding peasants, who don't really get to have any say in all of this, right? And again, the difference here is that in southern Scandinavia, you would have more tenant peasants, so they would have no political and very few legal rights. Whereas in a place like Norway or northern Sweden or you know, those areas, you would have a lot of freeholding peasants with a decent amount of political power and also some legal rights. So again, the situations are different depending on where we are. But so what are some historical situations where we see what comes close to a revolution? Well, we have Dormaldi, mentioned in Ynglinga Saga, who is a king of Sweden or Svealand or somewhere in the general area of Stockholm and Uppsala. And so the reasoning here in Ynglinga Saga is that the king guarantees the luck and prosperity and harvest of the land. And during a king's rule, we're expecting that to be the case. The king must perform all the rituals and rites that ensure that we don't starve and the crops go bad and all that stuff. Now, what happened during the reign of Dormaldi was that they had famine and the crops failed. And the first fall, what the Swedes did was that they went to the temple at Uppsala, according to this legend. It's not a history, it's a legend, of course, even though that it presents itself as history. The first year they sacrificed oxen, so basically some animals. Now, the second year, when the still crops were failing, they sacrificed humans. And then finally, in the third year, they decided to sacrifice the king. And that's
what you gotta do.
You gotta do what you gotta do. And so the question is,
it's his job to keep everyone safe.
Exactly, right? the question is, can we call that a revolution? Well, what did the French do when they starved?
Kill the king?
Yeah, they built guillotines, my friend. Let them eat cake is supposedly what Marie Antoinette said. I think that's actually a myth. She never really said that, but it was a great way to make people hate her even more and therefore also legitimize chopping off her head, right? Mm-hmm. Now, so that's like an example, like a historical example, presumably, of a situation where you see Scandinavians deciding, okay, enough is enough. This is now a revolution. The problem with, you know, interpreting this as a revolution is that it does not seem like there was a shift in government. Because what we're told is that Dormaldi was then succeeded by his son Dormar.
I mean, it depends if his son was significantly better or not.
Well, if
his son made sure everyone was fed, then to them it's a significant shift.
Sure, yeah, but if you look at it sort of like in the sense of like what defines revolution, what defines a mishap, a mishap of government, right? Then maybe this is not such a good case for revolution. On the other hand, you could, you know, make the case that during the Russian Revolution, right, you have a bunch of people who are like, oh, we're so much not Tsarist, we are totally communist. Now we're gonna revolt and overthrow the imperial power, blah, 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 blah. And then they instate a general secretary, is what they called it, right? Who essentially functions just like an emperor. So was that really a shift in government? I'm not sure about that. Speaking of which, Stalin also outlawed abortion. So just keep that in mind, guys. Hitler and Stalin.
I mean, track records. So if we're not talking about strictly what you would class as a revolution, what about on like a local level of like a yarl, who had like a small kind of, do you think that would be quite common that the people would be like, fuck this guy?
Yeah, absolutely.
like, I imagine all it would take is for one person within the community to be like, I could do better than that. Come and get behind me and start a little coup. And then you're just like, we can kill him and then I can take over.
But this is where loyalty plays in, right? So what is loyalty? Well, loyalty is the medieval version of having a Gestapo or a Stasi or some kind of secret Polizei, right? Because loyalty is like, you go to the local Jarl or to the king or whatever, and you swear fealty, right? And so now you're loyalty bound to the king. Well, what does that entail? Well, it entails to go tattle every time somebody at the local tavern is like, we should throw like the king in the ocean or something like that, right? Even if it's just some drunk old geezer, right? So
it's very rare that loyalty doesn't require some form of exchange of money or at least some benefit for the person who's being loyal. It's very, very rare for anybody that they're going to meet somebody in their life who is just loyal because they care and they love and they want the best for you. And hopefully everybody listening to this finds that person at some point in their life, but it's tough and it doesn't happen. Usually people are loyal to you because they either get something back from the exchange or they want something back. And then that's why they stay by your side. And it's the same thing with, like I say, with kings and Jarls, you know, they get protection or land. And then in that exchange, they then tell on the other people who may not be doing the right thing.
That's also what we know from, you know, the Viking Age and also earlier, what these rulers would do is that they would dispense gold rings. Right, so as a ruler,
arm rings. All the Viking Brothers are going to love this.
Yes, as you see it in the Northmen, by the way, arm rings, right? That you wear so that you also demonstrate to others that if you fuck with me, then I got a posse, right? That's what this is, right? So it's like the Viking Age version of having like a you know, biker gang backpatch too.
Oh, I was going to say a red bandana, but.
Whichever works. they're all gangs anyway.
They are all gangs.
Some just ended up getting to call themselves kings. so yeah, you have like these Vikings running around with bling, and then they of course will go tattle on you if you're not part of the gang and you're talking about overthrowing somebody who is the Jarl or the king or something like that.
Unless that person can offer them more, and then their loyalty is going to switch.
Exactly, because that's what loyalty really is, as I said, right? Mm-hmm. It's the Viking Age version of Gestapo. It's not mm-hmm. something that's like, oh, deep and heartfelt or anything like that. Just like when you have a shift in government, let's say you're having a nice little revolution in 1989, right? Now, if you're one of those guys who's standing around in those like green outfits with giant green hats by the Berlin Wall, and you're seeing all these people with, you know, axes and pitchforks and whatever they were carrying to take down that wall, and you're smart and you're kind of like, okay, figured out what this is, like,
you get off the wall and you pick up a pitchfork, yes, and you start kicking the fucking wall down so they don't kill you.
Yeah, exactly. And so that way you can,
that's
like,
what that's what I'd do. That's why I'd be a tanker. I'd be like, exactly. I don't want none of this.
So then all of a sudden you switch from being the Stasi to you know, helping create the new German government, right? And then you can perhaps become an informant for, you know, the Americans or whatever, right? So that's how that works. And it's no different back then, right? So you would also find situations where, you know, a bunch of people, they grow disgruntled with the current Jarl's reign. And so they all band together behind Ragnar and use the money that they made from pillaging Lindisfarne to then build up a counterforce to take over Kattegat, right? Because that happens.
I feel like I've heard this story somewhere before.
Oh, have you now? Yes, I think it was on TV once, but only on TV.
But do you think that situation would happen regularly, where you would have someone within the community that was unhappy with the way that the Jarl or whatever was running things, and would just get enough momentum behind them where they could overthrow? And also, is that how it would work? If you had like a Jarl in charge of a little Jarldom? I don't know if that's the right word. But Earldom? If you had a Jarl in charge of his little area and somebody came along and hit him with the pointy end of a sword and he fell over and died, would that person then automatically take that position? Because obviously that's kind of how you see it in the TV shows. It's like, well, you just come and you kill the guy in charge, and then it's like, no, I'm in charge. Is it that simple?
I mean, no, it's not that simple. It's not that simple. You know, there's actually a decent amount of like research that's gone into like, what does it take for the inner circle and all these different, especially military people involved, right, to actually turn on the dictator, whether it's Nicaragua or Honduras or anywhere else the CIA has tried to overthrow a government, right? That's where that research comes from.
Okay.
So there's a decent amount, like, and you know, there needs to be a significant for these. For all of these people who are down in like the second and third layer from the head of some kind of government that is not legitimately elected by the people and all that stuff, there needs to be a significant threat to their position from the outside that like seems to be so close that, you know, if I were, say, a general or something like that, I would lose everything if I didn't go with these other guys, right? Otherwise, they're gonna stay where they're at, right? That's their whole raison d'être. That's why they exist in the first place. They exist to be there.
Right? I also imagine that if you have someone in charge and then you have a bunch of people who are, you know, loyal to them and kind of underneath, and then an outsider comes along and kills the person in charge, and he's like, well, I now want to be in charge. I'm sure the people underneath would also go, okay, well, now he's gone, I think I have a claim to be in charge. Mm-hmm. And then you have this power vacuum of people who go, well, now they're not there anymore. There's a bunch of us who actually think that we should rule. So it's just that I've always found it interesting on TV. You kind of see, particularly like the Vikings TV show with Ragnar, and also with, I think Lagertha does it as well. She kills the chappie that she married, and then suddenly it's like, yeah, she rules now, and I just always wondered how accurate that was. Like if that was the case, it was just like, yeah, you killed them, so now you deserve to be.
You got to do your legwork before you can do that. Like you got to have a group of influential people who are backing you, and you know, actually, Queen Margaret the First of Denmark and Norway, and later on also Sweden, is a good example of this, right? She, her, like when Håkon, the Norwegian king, dies and leaves her with her quite young son in charge of the kingdom, which is technically a Norwegian kingdom that rules over Denmark, but that is forgotten in later revisions of the history. What she ends up doing is that she actually ends up through you know, a combination of persuasion and negotiation and also brute force. She ends up having all of these aristocrats of Denmark, Norway, and Sweden to actually come together and sign the so-called Union Treaties, which in which they all recognize her as their queen, or recognize her son as their king, but she's de facto the ruler of everything. So what you see there is that she was a really brilliant diplomat, and she had some really powerful people to back her up initially, because they had skin in the game for some reason. There was a reason for, say, like archbishops, for instance, to be on her side. There was a reason for a good amount of like Norwegian aristocrats and Danish aristocrats to be on her side to begin with, and therefore also pledge their armies to her. So that when you saw those, runaway aristocrats of like a couple of Norwegians and a bunch of Swedes being like, "Eh, no, we're not going to be part of this," then they could always like, she could always call in for backup, and that's how you end up with a situation where all of these nice aristocrats, they put their little seal on this Union Treaties letter. That you, I think you can go see at the Danish National Museum or the Norwegian one. I can't remember which one it is. But anyway, the point is that you need to have a solid foundation that includes swords and spears and boats and all the things. At least back then. Like nowadays, of course, it's a little different. Are there people who are like, "Oh yeah, no, I'm a I like now there's a power vacuum. I'm just going to try to step in." Yeah, that does happen. Are they successful? Not if they don't have a proper army with them, right? That's really what you need.
How important do you think that it was to be a good to be like a good strong warrior, I guess, to be to then step into that leadership role? And do you think it would be, if you could somehow get the backing of others, but you were a poor warrior or not known for maybe your fighting prowess, do you think you could then take that top role? Because I imagine it was very important to be kind of at least somewhat of a good warrior for people to get behind and follow.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we see this. So we assume that in the early Viking Age and before, if you were a proven warrior and so on, then you would have sort of like a backing from other warriors that know you or have heard of you, know your legend and all that stuff. In the same way as we, for instance, see the legionaries of Rome being enamored with the imperator, right? Following Julius Caesar or whomever it is, Marcus Aurelius, and all that stuff. Now, this is also the case later on, but again, there are other things that influence whether or not people are going to be following you, such things as already like status by birthright and other things, right? This comes down to this whole situation. It's like, "Oh, well, if he was born rich, it must mean that he is blessed by the gods, or that he is somehow accomplished." Like you see that even in modern democracies like the Italian and this one, right? It's like the assumption that somebody who's like born into power and riches is like a more accomplished human being than other people. And it's like, okay, that's kind of backwards, but whatever. So yeah, no, that I think there's like multiple factors that need to be taken into consideration. But there's also another thing, right? And that's religion. In the Viking Age, religion is also an element of people's motivations and who are they going to follow and so on. And we have, for instance, in Norway, under the rule of sorry, blah,
It's
Saint
all
Olaf,
right.
of course.
Hang on, shall I edit this together? you pretend that when Mateus says Blair, Sadolov Mateus, that's who you're thinking of.
Yeah, totally. Yes. So under the rules,
Shan's going to edit that together perfectly, so I sound really smart there. I trust in him.
So Saint Olav in Norwegian history is a pretty famous king. Now I think, you know, in modern interpretations of his reign, he's been projected as a very positive king, sort of like a hero of the people and a bunch of other things. Now, if we read between the lines of the historical record, he was a fucking shithead for many reasons. But the primary one was that he would kill and torture people who did not convert to Christianity. And he was very adamant about this. He is the king who Christianizes Norway. Olav Tryggvason is credited with converting Norway to Christianity, but it is Olav the Holy who really does it. And yes, Norwegians and other Scandinavians will know him for having Christianized Norway by the sword, as Elisa is pointing out. And there is an uprising against him led by this guy named Thorir Hundur, which means Thorir the dog. And he is motivated by religion, presumably, and manages to, you know, gather people around him. Now, you know, this is all fused with the Battle of Stiklastadir, which is, you know, a famous battle that in the history of the Norwegian kings, as it is written by Snorri Sturluson, presumably in Heimskringla, is actually more, you know, the significance is more something that has to do with the reign of Norway and not religion. And of course, these two things come together in different ways, but it's also very much, you know, a matter of like which dynasty actually gets to hold Norway. And the dynasty that was mostly in charge of Norway during this time period was the dynasty of Knut the Great and Harald Bluetooth. So Knut the Great is not really a Danish king because he's like ruling from England, but you know, this is how you write history, right? From a national romantic perspective. Oh, he was so much a Danish king. It was like, even though he never really set foot in Denmark, but and that kind of stuff. And he ruled Norway. but yeah, so we have Knut, we have Olav. Olav presumably representing this the line that can trace their ancestry back to Harald Finehair, except that is very questionable. That's really the case. Usually, you know, dynasties, they last for 3 to 4 generations, and that's really it. And actually, Knut the Great is a great example of this, right? Because his family has been in charge of Denmark for about 4 generations, and then it kind of stops with him, mm-hmm. even though we like to, you know, say that it didn't. But that's another conversation. The point is, though, that what we have here are, you know, we have a pretender to the throne, we have somebody on the throne, and then we have people motivated by such things as religion to like choose sides in this battle as well. And one of the really funky things about actually the Battle of Stiklastad is that we can see that it was a lot about religion. And one of the reasons that we can see that it was a lot about religion is that there's so much folklore that has persisted since about religion. Like, for instance, this particular presumed bishop or whatever, priest who fought in the Battle of Stiklastad and then had to flee and then ended up in northern Denmark and then build a church, right? Like, that's a sort of like medieval folklore that has to do with religion about that battle. which, you know, tells you a couple of things about just like cultural memory. You know, cultural memory always sort of, you know, simplifies what happened and why and so on. And one of the things that it remembers is religion was part of it, right? That's why you have some guy who flees the battle and then ends up in Denmark building a church. So that's another motivator that is, of course, important. And we can draw parallels to near contemporary, early modern situations. Like, for instance, the French Revolution, religion was also a factor there. The American Revolution, religion was definitely also a factor there, even though that is downplayed actually in contemporary historical representations of the creation of the modern American state or Union states, and you know, so on and so forth. Religion definitely always has a place in these. At least when there's a choice, I guess, in these events as well. And so this brings us to the last little bit.
Go on, let's go.
You want to wrap this up?
Go on.
There is the Song of Grotti, which is this poem.
Are you going to sing to me?
I am going to sing to you. This poem. Oh,
I've had the worst week. So you singing to me right now will fucking make it all
better. I will serenade you, man.
I'm going to close my eyes, and I'm going to sit in this moment forever. With this, as Aerosmith once said.
The revolutionary words of Fenya and Menya, these two so-called giantesses that have been captured by the evil Danish king Frodi, and then they are being forced to grind.
I love our chat. Just do it with an R&B bass, which I don't. I think she meant like a drum and bass from your.
Actually, it's a much better story if I was trying to do R&B back in the day. No,
if it was R&B, then I think you were trying to fuck me, so it'd be a bit weird.
Okay, yeah, no, none of that. Speaking of R&B, you do have Usher still, so that's good.
My boy Usher in the corner.
Okay, so the Song of Grotti is called a Eddic poem. It is not found in the main manuscript of Eddic poetry. It called Codex Regius. It's found usually in Snorri's Edda. Or not usually, it is in Snorri's Edda. And it goes, now there have come to the king's dwellings two foreknowing women, Fenya and Menya, the mighty girls were with Frodi, Fridleif's son, kept as slave girls. They were led to the mill box and they ordered the gray stones to grind into motion. To neither girl did he promise rest or pleasure until he had heard the slave girls clatter. They kept up the noise of the no longer silent mill. Let's set up the mill box. Let's lift up the stones. He ordered the girls again to get grinding. They sang and they swung the fast turning stone while Frodi's household mostly fell asleep. Then said Menya, who'd got down to the milling,
This actually sounds like it could be an Usher track. these sound like you just put a little bass behind this and a little bit, it could be
also the stumbling over the words.
Usher could be singing this to me right now.
Wealth, let's mill for Frodi, mill in all blessed state. Mill a mass of money in the joyful mill box. May he sit on his wealth. May he sleep on a down quilt. May he wake to happiness. Then the grinding's gone well. Here no one shall harm another, nor plan evil, nor plot against the life, nor strike with a sharp sword, even if he finds his brother's killer trussed up. He said nothing until he said this. You shan't sleep any more than the cuckoos over the hall, nor longer than I take to sing a single song. Frothy, you weren't entirely wise about your own interest, elegant friend to men. When you bought the slave girls, you chose them for their strength and their appearance, but you didn't ask about their lineage. Hrungnir was stern, as was his father, though Thjazi was mightier than they. Edi and Ernir, our close kinsmen, mountain giants' brothers, we're descended from them. Grotti would not have come out of the gray mountain, nor the hard boulder out of the earth, nor would the mountain girl keep grinding so if we had known nothing about it. 9 winters we were playmates, strong girls, brought up under the earth. The girls were doers of mighty deeds. We ourselves moved the mountain seat from its place. We rolled the boulder over the giant's dwelling so that the earth in front of it began shaking. We swung the fast-turning stone, the heavy boulder, so that men seized it. And afterwards, in Sweden, we 2 foresighted ones advanced in the army. We challenged bear-like warriors. We smashed shields. We marched through the gray corslet army. We overthrew one prince. We supported another one. We gave good Guthorm help. There was no sitting quiet until Knui fell. So we went on for some seasons so that we were acclaimed as champions. There we scored with sharp spears, blood out of wounds and reddened the sword. Now we have come to the king's dwellings, we 2 without mercy, and are kept as slaves. Mud eats away at our feet. Chilled through is the rest of us. We drag the strife calmer. It's dull at Frodi's. Hands shall rest, the stone stand still. I have ground out my full share. Now our hands will be given no proper rest until it seems to Frodi we've milled it all out. Hands shall grip hard shafts, slaughter-stained weapons. Wake up, Frodi, if you want to hear our songs and our ancient tales. I see fire burning east of the fortress, news of war awakening. That's known as a beacon. An army will come here very shortly and burn down the settlement despite the prince. You shan't hold on to the throne of Lyra, nor the red gold rings, nor this magical millstone. Let's grasp the handle, girl, more tightly. We're not frozen stiff in slaughtered men's blood. My father's daughter ground fiercely, for she saw warrior multitudes doom. The great supports snapped away from the millbox, enclosed in iron. Let's grind further. Let's grind further, Yrsa's son. Takes a vengeance on Frodi with the half Danes. He'll be famed as both her son and brother, as we 2 know. The girls ground, they tested out their strength. The young girls were in giant rage. The wooden mill shafts shuddered, the mill box collapsed, the heavy grindstone broke in 2. And the mountain giant women spoke these words. We've ground Frodi to the point where we must stop. The women have done a full stint of milling. And that's the end of that.
There we go.
Revolutionary women. Grinding the millstone until they're like, fuck it, we're done. Here's an army. And there you
that
go.
That sounds like a lot of Usher songs as well.
How the hell does it sound like an Usher song?
Those women grinding is definitely in many Usher songs. I'm telling you that. I've heard that in many Usher songs. All right, let's wrap this up. Yeah, again, this was kind of a last minute recording. It seems at the minute, you know, both me and yourself are going through stuff left, right, and center. Every time we try and level out, something comes along and just knocks one of us off a little bit. I had the loss of a close family member, I guess, this week, which is kind of fucked this week up for us and put things a little bit wonky, I guess. So again, we appreciate everybody sticking with us as we have had a tumultuous start to 2022. I guess we've been kind of here, there, and everywhere. We are getting back to normal and getting guests booked more regularly. We just unfortunately can't seem to catch a break at the minute. But we'll get there. We'll definitely get there.
Yes, we will. Yeah. It's been an interesting 2022 so far. Hopefully we can get a somewhat more leveled out and peaceful next 6 months.
I'm sure without a doubt eventually it will calm and we'll get back to how we want. I mean, we have such a good following and such a good core group of people who particularly support us on Patreon. They really do feel like true friends and family. You know, when anything ever happens to me or you, you know, they're always quick to reach out and check that we're okay. And that certainly means a lot to me. And I know
it definitely does.
So yeah, we'll get there. We'll get back to where we were, I think, because we hit a really good stride and we were in a really good rhythm, and then life just seems to be tripping us up at the minute, but you just got to roll with the punches and eventually it kind of will level back out. I know we've got some exciting things in August at a festival in Norway.
A certain festival in Norway. I've just received the list of speakers and it is looking marvelous. So
we've got some nice things to do there. We're going to record some live shows, and we've got some good guests in the future that we want to get on. It's just at the minute with things changing all the time, it's hard to keep guests because we might let them down. We don't want to let people down. So sometimes it's easier just to do a quick recording with us two when things are a little up in the air.
That is true.
So yeah, it'll level back out. We'll be there, and particularly in Patreon, we've got some exciting things we want to do. I know you want to do some more knowledge-based things for people who support us on there and try and give back. But we appreciate everybody who supports us through this. We do seem to be hopefully nearing the end of kind of the shit storm, I think. So if you do want to help us out, Patreon is just / Nordic Mythology Podcast. The lowest one is the price of a coffee for either me or Matthias. And it helps us keep growing the podcast. Either we employ Shan, who does the editing. Ron now has come on board and started taking over the social media. He's doing an amazing job with creating videos and highlight clips that we can put up and hopefully start to grow the podcast. So it really goes to good use. It's not like we take the money and just go and get drunk. We literally save every penny and invest it back into hopefully trying to make a better show for everybody listening. We really do appreciate that, and everybody who can jump on there and support us. Matthias, where can people find you and see your tattooing?
Well, as I mentioned, you can find me on Instagram. I exist there. So that's a thing. You can also have a look at my website. It's my name.com. Dan, where can people find you?
Daniel_Farron1 on Instagram. If you want to send me whiskey, please just ask me for an address. Feel free. Whiskey would cheer me up right now, I'll tell you that.
I mean, I wouldn't say no to whiskey either.
Send us both whiskey. Why not? Daniel_Farron1, obviously at Hornsbone. I appreciate the support that I get. I a lot of the time I get new orders or emails that people say that they love the podcast, they appreciate what we do. So that's always really nice. So I always appreciate the support across any channel, wherever it comes from, particularly at the moment. And if you enjoy the show, please, if there's a 5-star rating, a positive review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts, and YouTube. Obviously, like we said, Ron's doing a lot with videos at the minute. He's putting up a lot of clip and just small clip videos on YouTube and the full episodes. So pop over to YouTube.com/NordicMythologyPodcast. Subscribe, hit the little bell notification so you know whenever a new episode drops, you get to see our two faces and whoever our guest is. And we can just, yeah, I guess it adds another dimension to it rather than listening to it. You can see.
Absolutely. Yeah. You get the chance to watch me pick my nose while somebody is talking at me. So it's great.
Mm-hmm. And Sophie just said that if you want to suggest clips, obviously, there's a channel for that in our Discord. Our Discord is amazing. It's like a little family of people. You can either join the Patreon and you get access to the Discord automatically, or just ask me or Mateus for the link and we can give you that. And I think it's probably on the website, NordicMythologyPodcast.com as well. And it is such a nice group of people in there. I'm really proud of kind of the collection of people we've managed to put together through this podcast, and they've become close friends of mine. So there we go. That's my soppy ending.
It's a good one.
Which I feel like I need at the minute. Yeah. Just to be surrounded by love. So yeah, thank you. Thank you very much to everyone. Mateus, thank you very much. Take care.
Bye everybody.
Bye everybody.